Recorded live from the mats of Radical MMA in New York City, the Martial Culture Podcast, your source for in-depth combat sports and martial arts insights with Coach Rene Dreyfus and Matt Pierce. Ring the bell and let's get it on.
What you got there, you little snacky boy?
Snacks. What are they? Peanut butter pretzels?
Pretzels with peanut butter.
Pretzels with peanut butter. Yeah. What are they called? Like, what's the brand?
I don't know.
Oh. But thank you for where they're delicious.
Pantry.
I actually don't like, New York is known for its pretzels, but I actually don't like pretzels that much. You know, aside from my dad's German heritage, I'm a terrible German. I don't like beer. I don't like pretzels. It's like most German things I enjoy, but pretzels are not one of them, unless it's really, really, really good. But mostly New York pretzels, it's like a winter thing with the salt and the heatness because you're mostly cold.
You once you see one corner cart that pulls pretzels out of like a cardboard box that was on the ground for 3 days. It kind of ruins the illusion of the New York City pretzel.
Yes.
Yeah. I've had one.
Yeah.
And they are not fresh.
No.
They're very hard. No good.
You know, it's funny because an article just said that in New York, street vendors, the meat they use is not what they actually say it is. Like, it's supposed to be like labeled as beef, and sometimes it's like, nobody knows, right? Oh, yeah. So they just actually caught. They're like, this is not the meat you said it was. Who knows what kind of meat it was? When you eat it, it's what's called street meat. Your hands, your life is in danger.
It's a mystery. My first week here, I was very excited to try a New York City hot dog, water dog.
Yes.
I worked on 34th Street. I walked out, went around the corner. There was a guy on the corner, got a hot dog, went to Bryant Park, sat on the bench, doing the whole New York thing. Disgusting. It was like eating Play-Doh. It had no bite to it. It was just mush.
You know what? This is what my mom said. She'd kill me that I said this. She goes, the dirtier the guy's hands are, the better it tastes.
I'm sure it adds something delicious.
It adds a little bit of extra tang.
Thank you.
No, I actually think there's been a degeneration in the quality, because when I was a kid, they were pretty good.
I'm sure.
And right now, I had, it's funny.
Like when they first invented hot dogs, they had to be.
Oh, that's funny.
You and Nathan down at the pier.
That's really funny. I see an age joke has crept into the podcast here. yes, I'm old enough to be your dad, but no, I'm not old enough to the invention of hot dogs. Right?
No, you weren't there.
I wasn't there in the Stone Age when they first made a hot dog. but it's interesting. They the first hot dogs, I guess, were stuffed intestines of organ meats and stuff.
I watched a documentary. I'd say documentary, I guess, loosely, about the invention of hamburgers. And it was a guy in not hamburger like way back in Hamburg, but like American hamburgers. There was a guy somewhere in the South, and he was making lunch. And for this guy that was very impatient, and he was making meatballs. And the guy said, come on, hurry up. I need to go.
Yeah.
And so he flattened the meatballs out of anger.
Oh. And just put on two slices of bread or something. That's the whole idea of the Earl of Sandwich. He's like, I want to eat something while I'm playing cards. And the guy's like, okay, meat inside bread, go. But obviously people have been doing bread with things inside of them for, thousands of years. But
this documentary was it didn't happen until 1922. I'm like, that doesn't sound legit.
I would say, when I went to Hamburg, which is where my dad was from, actually, they eat Hamburg steak, which is like meatloaf, it's like a meatloaf, there's no bun. Mm-hmm. So I do think the bun meat combination is an American thing, but steak, ground up beef cooked on a griddle is not from 1922. It's from much earlier.
What kind of podcast is this? We're talking about food for the first.
Food.
Are
we
hungry?
I am hungry. But, it's the same thing I was saying. I went to eat a street dog, a little while ago. I'm like, oh my God, this is terrible. Yeah. Nothing like what I used to remember.
Have you ever had a Zweigels?
A Zweigels? What's that?
It's a brand of hot dog.
No.
Oh, it's from, started in Rochester.
Oh.
Really good. I'm going to get you some Zweigels. They have white hot and red hot.
Oh, I can't eat spicy.
No, they're not. They're just, that's the brand name.
Oh, God.
They just taste like regular hot dogs.
Oh.
Yeah. But one is the pork and one is beef. So white hots are pork. Can you eat?
I prefer beef yeah. hot dogs, right? I'm not like the biggest, I'm not a religious thing or anything like that. I mean, nothing more dietary. It's just, I generally don't eat much pork because most of the time I don't like the taste. Yeah. But I actually eat pork chops. I like pork chops and I don't like bacon. I don't like flavored bacon.
No, that's a lie. Like, you can say you don't want to eat bacon, but you can't say you don't like
bacon. I don't like it. I don't like the taste or the smell of bacon.
That's insane.
No, you know why? And this is first world problems. Because my dad loved bacon. No. And every goddamn morning for years of my life, wake up to the smell of bacon over and over again. And then finally just got sick of it. My sister, too. When she moved out of living with my parents, you know, when we grew up, she became a vegetarian just because she was so sick of eating meat for a while. We were just thinking, very lucky. Look, very privileged, very lucky, first world problems. But, you know, I just got so sick of it, you know. And my mom would cook bacon very crispy and very greasy. So you'd always get like a little bit of an upset stomach. My mom's a great cook, but there's some things, you know, obviously, the way my dad liked it, I guess. Mm. And so I can't look at bacon without like, bleh.
You mean like on a hamburger?
No, I hate it. It ruins the taste for me.
Wow.
The only time I can kind of eat it is if it's not greasy and you put it on a BLT with tomato, like a lot of juice to take away the, you know, the edge of the greasiness.
Yeah, a turkey bacon?
No, you know, I tried that because my wife loves bacon. She loves bacon, right? Mm. So she bought turkey bacon. And I'm like, okay, I could eat it, but I don't like it, right? Yeah. You know, like I actually want to spit it out, but I'll be respectful or not. I could eat it, though. Like it doesn't like turn my stomach.
Yeah, Brian used to eat the vegan bacon, which just looks like Band-Aids.
Yeah, I cooked up vegan bacon once, and I'm like, this looks like, it looked like what the... if a leper had his skin fall off and you cooked it, and it just looked so unappetizing. Yeah. It was made from mushrooms. Was those made from mushrooms?
I don't know. It was a Morningstar.
This is supposed to be really healthy. So I cooked it up and I was like, yeah, don't buy this again.
Yeah. Did it taste like bacon?
It didn't, you know, it had that bacon smokiness because they put the artificial smoke flavor, but it didn't have that burnt porky kind of flavor at all, right? Which is why I was like, oh, I could eat this. I don't like it. It doesn't taste good, but I could eat it.
Yeah.
But it was eating like shoe leather.
Yeah. Why they eat shoe leather? There's probably more minerals than that.
Yeah. Anyway.
Off of food.
The last podcast, we talked about that ultimate self-sufficient challenge. You just mentioned that he made his goal for funding.
Reached his goal on this funding. I can't remember what website it was, but yeah.
His website.
Fully funded.
Do they have a date for the next show?
I didn't see that. And he only wanted to raise like $30,000, which doesn't seem like enough. But you should probably get more. Doesn't seem like that's not enough to produce like this whole... It was very well produced.
Yeah,
he
did a great job. Yeah. For the ones that haven't seen it, we're talking about the Ultimate Self-Defense Challenge or Challenge, not Championship. Challenge, right. Championship, right. Championship, you're right. And, we talked about it in the last episode. It was really, really, really well done. And he has next season, and it's cool. I heard that the next season will have like some Kung Fu guys, a whole different other martial art practitioners. I really hope they get like a Krav Maga guy on to expose this, like why this stuff doesn't work.
It'd be so like 100 guys, like that, mix that other show with this show. The
100, physical 100, yeah. Yes. Totally. That would be, but you know, if he's doing all the editing himself, which he said he did, and he's doing all the post-production work, and then it's only the expense of flying guys out and room and board, and then the renting out of the facility, which I think he has some agreement with the facility guys. But supposedly that whole facility is going to be taken down. They're going to tear it down. So this is the last one they're going to do in that facility. Wow. I think that way too much space anyway. They could probably do it somewhere else.
Yeah. A little paintball range or something.
Yeah. In middle America, there's got to be like tons of places like that. You could, yeah, like exactly. Like, that's a great idea. Like a paintball range. And not just, have you seen the indoor paintball ranges? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly like that. Yeah. Yeah. Or a parkour range, you know, something like that.
Take them down to Langley. And they got shooting ranges down
there.
They
do have shooting ranges, yeah.
Get in there.
Actually, in Radical, so we have three floors. The top floor, I'm thinking of having a dry fire shooting range. So dry fire meaning no ammunition because you can't. You have to have a license. But
Al Gawn will be there.
That's not even a good joke, man. That's terrible. That's so bad.
He loves shooting stuff.
I don't think he likes shooting stuff. You're so bad sometimes. But that didn't make me laugh.
Wouldn't it still be loud?
I'm sorry?
Is it still going to be, is it like blank? So it's still loud?
No, it's not even blank. So this is, you attach a firearm, and by this we wouldn't even use, we'd use like a simulated firearm. Like, so you have these, pellet guns that are exact replicas of like a Glock
like
or whatever.
Airsoft gun.
Yeah, airsoft, mm-hmm. Exactly. So I have an airsoft. It's so crazy. It was expensive, but it's so crazy how much of an exact replica was of a Glock. Like, you would never know that it was a fake gun. It's almost like dangerous. This is why they paint on the side. There's a little sticker that says fake gun. Cause like, it's mm-hmm. legit. Like, you know, like, look, that actually feels heavy like a Glock too. Remember, it's been a while since I had a Glock in my hand, but it actually, the airsoft one feels a little bit heavier, if I remember correctly. You have another one, Beretta, like they're real exact models. Now, what you do is, but these dry fire things, it's a laser that you connect to your gun and you press the trigger and a laser fires onto a target, a sensor. And so you know exactly where you hit and you could just do it over and over and over again. And obviously you don't waste ammunition. Funny enough, like if anybody has done target range practice, the cost of ammunition is like insane after a while if you really want to practice. Like it's really a lot of money. So I don't do target practicing, I don't do it, but something that I did as a kid, grew up in a family of, my father was a hunter, liked to hunt, and so, you know, he felt that understanding the safety of firearms was very important. So when I was 10, I went to this ranch, which was like teach you how to ride horses and things like that. And then at the same time, they would teach you other skills. And one of them was like marksmanship and also gun safety, which was really important, like how to be responsible. But my training has always been in long guns, never in handguns. Huh. Yeah. But like, that's expensive. I remember that course it was done. Here's the cost of your ammunition. I'm like, glad my dad's paying.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
we went to $1980.
We went to the shooting range for the day before my wedding. My brother was paying for everything. I was like, Jesus.
Oh, where expensive. Was the shooting range? Up in Rochester?
Buffalo.
Oh, Buffalo.
Yeah.
But you're from Rochester.
Yeah, we got married in Buffalo because it was closer to her family.
Oh.
Not much closer, but close enough. And the place we got married at was really cheap.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when you get outside of New York, everything's so much cheaper. I was just talking to a student of mine. He's like, yeah, we got to move out of New York. He's like, unfortunately, I might have to cancel membership because, like, it's just too expensive here. Inflation is crazy now.
Yeah.
Cost of food. But, hopefully all the supply chain stuff will be resolved and we can go back to, like not paying, like, 20 bucks for a case cast of eggs.
Wow, eggs.
Anyway, speaking of these things, it brings me to a much more darker subject. We're talking about self-defense. And some of you guys, we have listeners from around the world. I'll cue you what happened is exactly 1 month ago in New York, there was an incident on the New York subway station. And I would like to discuss this, a very, very serious discussion. I want to discuss it from a couple of different angles. The first is a self-defense angle. The second is a practitioner's angle on rear naked chokes and things like that. So there was an incident, I believe it was on the A train, the New York, for the people who don't listen to New York, New York has a number of different subway lines and they cut across Manhattan and other boroughs. And so they run through the center of the city, but they also run to neighborhoods that are very different in scope. So obviously Manhattan is, you know, business people and things like that. And very, not as many people living in Manhattan as there are in the suburbs. And the trains that run through, some run through neighborhoods that are a little bit, more economically distressed. And some of them don't. Some run through neighborhoods that are very, very wealthy. And sometimes it's the same train going through different neighborhoods. I know, obviously Matt's like, yes, I know this. But for our listeners in Israel and Australia, these are, you know, kind of things, right? So on one of the trains, you had an ex-Marine, and his name was hold on, let me get the whole situation. This was on May 1st. A former U.S. Marine sergeant. His name was Daniel Penny. He put a individual by the name of Joseph Neely in a chokehold in a engagement, and it became a tragic situation. I'll play up. Did you watch the video of the incident? Yeah. So maybe you can describe what happened. Do you know what happened before the chokehold was placed on? Let's start from there.
The gentleman got on the train and was asking for food and being kind of aggressive, but not violent.
Not violent, but very aggressive.
Loud, aggressive. Which is something you see on the train.
Has that ever happened to you, that someone got on the train and was aggressive and loud and something like that?
Yes.
Did that ever scare you?
Yeah, I think every time you feel a little nervous, you move to the other side of the train, you kind of get away, you go to a different car. I've gotten off the train before and took the next one.
Yes.
Just because it's not worth it.
No, and that's exactly right. I think everybody who's grown up in New York has had this experience of being on the train, particularly late at night. And I think you're a big guy, but imagine if you're a small lady.
I was with my wife, who's a lot smaller than I am, and a person, I'm standing right next to her, and a guy stood in front of her and yelled in her face. Expletives and was just yelling at her.
Wow.
And then got off the train.
Yeah.
So, like, of course. Yeah. Even if I was standing right next to her, they don't know, like, I'm with her. So they're still going to do something.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Nothing's ever happened to me directly, but, like, yeah.
I've had tons of these experiences. Because you grow up in New York, you always have these experiences, right? But one of them was, I was sitting on the train with my wife. And this is before my wife was doing martial arts. Now she's much more aware. But I remember sitting on the train. And I've talked about this on the podcast before, but there was a person who's obviously on drugs, most likely bath salts, and extremely erratic in their behavior. Not aggressive to anybody, but like muttering and all these kind of like behaviors that are indicative of emotional or psychic distress. And then I was looking, I mean, it looked like that person was going to jump up and attack someone at any moment. They're tensing and I was like, wow, this could go really bad right away. And they were zoning in on things, right? A lot of times this happens where you have someone, they kind of obsess over one thing and they become very aggressive to that point. That's also happened. But then what happened was just when I was like, you know, ready to maybe stand up and take care of the situation, that person walked off the station, the doors opened, walked off. Stood in front of a metal pole and started banging their head as hard as they could against the metal pole. It was crazy. Blood everywhere. But the doors closed and we left. I was like, whoa, this was nuts. Now, I was not in any danger at that moment. Close. But yeah, it's extraordinarily, like, stressful and frightening to people who are, particularly people who aren't trained, but even myself, I was like, whoa, how do you deal with this scenario? Particularly, violence has not happened yet, but you feel very threatened. And like you said, someone's screaming in your face. This is indicative of some very serious mental distress, and that can go from that to punching. I've seen literally thousands of videos where it goes from yelling right to an assault right away. You have to treat verbal aggression as a type of warning and a type of aggression. Mm-hmm. That being said, if they're not actively attacking you under New York state law, it is not a defensible position for assault. You have to have been attacked to defend yourself, right? Mm-hmm. So New York state law and different, you know, different states or different New York, we have, for the people that don't live in U.S., every state has state law and there's certain federal laws, but a lot of these criminal statutes about like street crime are obviously, they're limited to the scope of that state. So you follow the state law, right? And New York state law we do not have a stand your ground issue like things like Texas and Florida where you feel threatened, you can pull out your gun and shoot people, which is sometimes, you know, very, very dangerous precedent, but that's a different subject. But this verbal threatening aggression is, especially if you don't understand what's going on, or you don't feel confident in your ability to defend yourself, can be extraordinarily frightening. And how you handle it as a martial artist is extremely important. You understand the law, the legal framework of what's going on, because self-defense does not finish when the engagement is over. Self-defense can finish in the courtroom where you're facing legal charges. So this individual, Joseph Neely, got on, was highly aggressive verbally, said he wanted to die too, or he was, this is the day he felt like he was going to die. He had no money. He was hungry. And he was ranting because he was in severe emotional distress. The background of him is that he actually, his mother was murdered when he was a child or a teenager, grew up, had very PTSD from this moment, was a the type of performer. He would do Michael Jackson impressions, but slowly delved deeper and deeper into mental distress and became homeless. And it's a tragic story. This is part and parcel of what the experience is in New York, because we have so many people who need mental help that really aren't getting it, and they're interacting with us every day. And it's like a majority of people incarcerated have some sort of mental health problem. The almost over half the prison population is people who actually are mentally handicapped.
Yeah.
But we treat them as criminals. So this is a social problem way beyond this interaction. But let's zoom back down to the interaction. He gets on the train. He's aggressive. Does not hit anybody. So the former Marine, Daniel Penny, does what? You saw it, right?
Put him in a chokehold.
Came from behind him and put him in chokehold. The chokehold was actually incorrect. It was completely incorrect. But it was applying. So there's two chokeholds, two types of chokeholds. There's a carotid choke, which is actually a strangulation, and an actual choke, which is on the trachea, the airways. You're either choking the blood or the airways. Now, this was mostly on the carotids, but it actually attacked the airways too, because he was doing it incorrectly. Just for some context, the carotid arteries collapse under 5.5 to between 5.5 and 22 pounds of pressure, right? While vertebral arteries, which are actually deeper in your, because there's four arteries, there's two carotids and two vertebrals, right? Vertebral arteries collapse under 18 to 66 pounds of pressure. So we're doing 5 pounds to 22 versus 18 to 66. This has been known in the medical literature. People who put on rear naked chokes, particularly expert practitioners who've had their chokes measured, can generate in excess of 150 force pounds per square millimeter. That's insane. Wow. So you're already dealing, if carotids collapse under 5, and expert practitioners, actually, I've done this. I actually, this is going to sound self-serving, but my the force I've generated with my choke is way in excess of 150 pounds of force. But
I remember.
You remember. But I've actually measured it. But expert practitioners of jiu-jitsu who've been tested, and they did a whole study, on average of 150 force pounds, right? But it could even be more, right? This is average. It takes 5 to 22 pounds to collapse the carotids within seconds, right? So you put the chokehold on. Let's say it was a terrible chokehold. He's still way above what it needs to collapse the carotid arteries. Now, just to say that the trachea collapses, the airway collapses under 33 pounds of force, and the cricoid cartilage, which is near it, will fracture under 45 pounds of pressure. Okay? So the cartilage in front of your trachea. So as I said, it was mostly an air choke, but there was pressure on the trachea, as you can see from the video. There's some pressure there. But mostly, so if he's doing, say, a crappy choke and he's putting on 75 pounds of force, so meaning 50% effective, right? 25 pounds of force, he's already collapsing those carotids very effectively.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about how a choke works. So, brain damage occurs from hypoxia. Hypoxia is lack of oxygen. How long do you think it takes to start neural trauma when full hypoxia, I mean no oxygen, results? How long do you think? So no oxygen, how long does brain trauma start?
2 minutes?
Immediately. Once oxygen has been deprived. So this is very interesting. It's not just, and I wish we had a physician here as well, but it's not just the lack of oxygen, but it's also, from the choke, you generate a lot of intracranial pressure, which these together lead to, because you're have a venous, is a carotid inflow, blood inflow, and venous outflow, meaning there's blood going in your brain from your carotids and flowing out of your brain, your from your veins. When you're choking someone, you're disrupting all of that. Yeah. So there's not, the venous outflow is not there, right? So you're generating a lot of intracranial, meaning inside the brain, pressure inside the brain. This is not good for brain health. Mm-mm. Not to mention you're cutting off circulation, right? And cutting off the oxygen. So the minute full hypoxia has been induced, you're already starting tissue infarction, means tissue death damage, right? Okay. So now, brain damage can begin within a minute or two of total oxygen deprivation. So true hypoxia triggers near instantaneous damage. Brain damage can begin with a minute or two of total oxygen deprivation. So at the 5 minute mark, death of brain cells and the severe brain damage that accompanied it become inevitable. So let me repeat this again. Minor oxygen deprivation only causes damage over time, but true hypoxia, true lack of oxygen, triggers near instantaneous damage. Brain damage can begin within a minute or two of total oxygen deprivation, meaning I cut off your oxygen, but there's still some oxygen in your brain. So obviously take a breath. There's some oxygen in your brain. Mm-hmm. Then I choke you and it takes a little time for that oxygen to run out. However, when it really runs out, then you start having brain damage. And as I said, the intracranial pressure has been noted to be also an instance, particularly when you're dealing with the capillaries that can damage the capillaries in your brain, all this other stuff, right? I'm not going to get into it. And of course, I'm not an expert on the subject. So I would like some of the physicians that listen to the subject to also can chime in. But obviously, getting choked, not good for your brain health. How long did Daniel Penny hold this choke for? Do you know?
Is it like 15 minutes?
15 minutes. Now, do you know what happened? While he, have you ever seen someone get choked out?
Yeah.
On video or what yeah. happened? What happened in that video? Mm. I mean, not in the street, but like in a jiu-jitsu tournament or something like that.
So didn't his limbs like start moving involuntarily?
Exactly.
So they thought he was awake.
Right. So what happens is when you get choked out, a lot of times your body does these like nervous convulsion type things. Mm. Not convulsions and like convulsions, but like they'd start moving nervously. This happens all the time when you're choked out. It also happens when you release the choke. So this, I know this. Look, I'm not a physician, but I've probably choked out 700-800 people in my time. I don't even know. Like, I don't even know. Like I choked out a lot of people. Yeah. I don't do it anymore because I understand that, like, back in the day when we were training, this is very interesting. Back in the day, we used to not tap. We were like, oh, I'll just go out because it's not dangerous. However, we understand now that there is danger to not tapping. Yeah. There's called carotid dissection, which is an issue where you have a piece of your carotid artery can break off and then give you a stroke. That's actually the most common.
Damn.
And there's a couple guys in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu who have had that happen. So you should tap, right? But back in the day, we used to not tap at all, like to carotid restraints, not drinking.
How long would that last?
And I mean, you just tap out, you wake up and you go again, right? Yeah, right. But the minute you wake up, depending on how much you've been choked, a lot of times your limbs start flailing. And you start kind of like moving around and jerking around. When you're choking, that happens. And when you're released to choke, it happens. So it doesn't always happen, but it very often does. So he was flailing and they thought he was fighting. He wasn't fighting. He was dying. But they didn't know this. Part of the issue is Joseph Neely was trained by the Marine Corps Martial Art Program, which is not a high level technically based program. As we've talked many times, soldiers do not spend detailed amounts of time understanding the intricacies of technique in hand-to-hand combat because they're supposed to shoot people and launch warheads and airstrikes. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of get these crash courses in this. Particularly the Marine Corps program is substandard compared to the Army's. And all the Marines, my friends are going to kill me, but it's true. The Army realized way back in the day that their program was terrible and they adopted Gracie Jiu-Jitsu Fundamentals program, which is a Gracie combatives type program, but especially designed for the military, and also MMA training for their thing. So that you start out in the Gracie foundations and then you go into the MMA training afterwards, right? And that is actually a very good program. I mean, you know, obviously the quality of the instructors vary. The Marine Corps program, I think it was a little bit of inter-service rivalry. They didn't want to do the same thing that the Army did, even though they probably should have. So they tried to kind of copy MMA in their Marine Corps program. The original Marine Corps program was terrible. Then they created a new one, which is still not that good. And then they just basically try to copy MMA, but they don't really have the knowledge base other than maybe a certain practitioner here and there. One of my students was a reservist Marine, and he would go into training. And he was – when this happened, he was about 6 months training with me. Not even like 6 months. He was just a new white belt. But he went back into his battalion, and he tapped out all his combatives instructors, the Marine Corps martial art instructor, tapped them out. They're like, okay, let's fight. And he would just wreck them.
Wow.
So the instructors didn't have the same knowledge that someone has at Radical at 6 months. But on that's on the offense. But also you have to, as an instructor, understand the danger. So whenever I teach a choke, I go, this is what's happening, and this is what you have to look for to make sure it's safe. Right? And a lot of even jiu-jitsu instructors don't teach this. I remember I've had people talk to me about fights where they did a choke, let it go, the guy got up, and then they attacked him again because they hold the choke, and then they're like, okay, get out. He didn't get out, and the guy wakes up, and he just attacks him again. So what? At what point, you know, do you hold the choke to make sure that he won't be able to assault you again if you're not going to kill him?
Yeah.
Right? So – and then at what point are you killing him, right? That's a very important understanding of the time frames that happen. So I put the choke on. I'm going to count out. Probably, generally speaking, it's about 15 seconds where you can pretty much guarantee that they're really out of oxygen. At the fifth, I tell my students, at the 15-second mark of a choke, you're in the danger zone. That's where you're starting likely to do damage, depending on how much oxygen in their brain. But really, it's about 15 seconds where it starts the intracranial pressure. Everything starts getting dangerous. 15 seconds in a fight is like an eternity. It sounds like a little bit, but it is holding a full-on choke for 15 seconds, whether unconscious or not, is an eternity, right? Mm-hmm. Now, so in my experience, when you hold this choke for 15 seconds and go 5 seconds past, usually, like full out, they're out for 5 seconds. Out. Like you, they're out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They are going to wake up eventually, but they will be in no condition to fight. And what you do is in that time where they're out, is what I do is I recommend using their clothing to tie them up. In Japanese, it's called hojo. It's a kind of a tie-up technique. So I'd like, you tie their hands up behind their back with their jacket or shirt, and then you're okay. Yeah. So that's always what I recommend to my tactical training. Yeah, so you choke them out, 15 plus 5. Done. 15 seconds of full choke.
So they go guy, and come. Yeah. He heard this, and he thought you said 15 minutes.
Don't blame me. Like 15 choke, when you see them go out, and how do you know they go out? You'll feel the limpness. And this is experience. Yeah. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now, please, this is a general statement. Obviously, you can't make a blanket statement. I'm going to hold this. This is like always going to happen. That doesn't happen that way. And please, obviously, train with care. You should never be doing this in the dojo because it's too dangerous, particularly without supervision. This is in a self-defense situation. What do you do to make sure you're not getting hurt? Right now. So, but he held it. The guy flailed. Two other people were restraining the guy when he was flailing. But obviously they thought he was fighting. And they're actually complimenting the Marine on his choke. Which is crazy because the choke was terrible. But it was not technically correct. But even a badly performed choke can be very effective, right? So they held him, and he was just dead. So what should he have done? There was a really good video, and we'll put this in the show notes, of a black belt restraining a criminal. And what he did was he took his back, choked him a little, let him go, but held him in the crucifix position. And literally, this is a very funny video because he literally is the guy screaming, let me go, and fighting. And the jiu-jitsu black belt slowly reaches over because his hat was a little askew, takes his hat off, puts it on the side like it was nothing. And he's not hurting the guy at all. He is just restraining him. Mm-hmm. And he takes out his phone, starts calling 911, or I think he says to someone to 911, but he takes out his phone, puts it on the side, and then he tells someone to call and holds the guy till 911 arrives. So there was another incident in New York about 2 years ago. Similar situation. I don't know the background, but a black belt under Marcelo Garcia got into a street altercation, put the guy in a control position, but he said to him, he's like, and he knew legally when he was able to continue to fight. So he mounted him, had him in the gift wrap position, which is the arm is wrapped around your neck and the person has the hand behind you. So Matt, put your hand behind my head and hold you tight and pretend you're mounting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right? So you see I'm stuck.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So my hand is wrapped around my neck and your arm is behind my head and you're mounting me, so I'm stuck. So he held him in the gift wrap position, turned it, exposed his back, and held him there. And the same thing, had police call. And so the application of the rear naked choke in New York is a very interesting legal place, because if you cannot demonstrate actual self-defense, meaning your life is in danger, right? Physical, you can be facing manslaughter, felony assault charges, right? So it can be, you have a felony offense if you cannot demonstrate that it was a necessary thing to do. Mm. Now, when does it become excessive force? The minute you're no longer threatened with physical harm.
Yeah.
So if I have the guy in the gift wrap, right, legally in New York, if I have him in the gift wrap and he can't move and he's stuck, or I have him in crucifix and he can't move, if I extend further and choke him, I could be facing felony assault. Now, again, legally, I'm not a lawyer, so please take this with a grain of salt. I'm just saying, generally speaking, what the legal climate is in New York. Now, let's go back to this situation. At no point did the victim of this incident just nearly attack anyone. So there was no incidents of physical harm at that moment. Possible, but it didn't seem that way. Also, the individual put the rear naked choke came from behind. So he was never endangered because the other person wasn't even facing him. He felt that he was going to do this because he felt like he was protecting other people on the subway. And I think this comes from a good place because he felt other people were threatened. But according to New York State law, he was indicted on manslaughter charges. According to New York State law, if there are no extenuating circumstances, he is guilty of manslaughter.
Oh, does he think he's Batman? I mean, come on.
Right. But I will also say this. I was speaking of this with my mother, and my mother grew up in New York when it was very, very dangerous when we were kids in the 70s, and New York was dangerous. And there was an incident in New York. Do you remember the Bernard Goetz incident? Maybe you're a little too young for this one.
Name sounds familiar, but I don't.
Yeah, so this happened. It was kind of a similar thing, but involved a fire. So remember, in New York, the streets were really, really dangerous in the late 70s, early 80s, right? It was, mm-hmm. you know, warriors come out to play. You know, it was no joke, right? So a basic white-collar dude, his name was Bernard Goetz, had to take the middle class white collar dude had to take the train every day, and the train was not safe at night. So he bought a firearm, a handgun. And these young kids came in and were verbally threatening to him. I don't know exactly what was said. This was like 1980, you know, a long time ago. But they were verbally harassing him in some way. And then he I believe, if I remember it correctly, he gave them a warning. And they were still verbally threatening him. And, you know, a little bit of that kind of shakedown thing that street toughs do. Pulled out his gun and shot him. And they ran away and he kept shooting him. So this became a lightning rod case in New York because everybody could kind of like empathize with Bernie Goetz's plight, because nobody wants to be on a subway and victimized. I get this, right? And it drew, just like this case, it draws very much on racial lines. A lot of people on the minority community, African-American, Latino community, feel that, you know, they are the victims of sometimes police brutality and sometimes excessive assault because their communities are targeted in this way. That's what they feel. People on the more the white communities feel like, hey, well, safe streets, this guy's threatening. And I see both sides. This is not an easy issue. It's not like you're wrong and I'm right. And I talked to a very good friend of mine, and he's like, you know, this is another example of like, you know, murdering of an innocent black guy. And I'm like, I totally see your point, because yes, he was threatening, but he's also mentally unstable. He's a danger just as much to himself as anyone else. This is a victim of, you know, horrible, horrible circumstances. And really the people create this, the people, the social systems that are not there to help out. And, you know, these guys, the system is, the problem is much larger than this incident. But at the end of the day, it is this incident. Mm-hmm. A guy is making people feel very afraid on the street at night. And another guy steps in to help out, but doesn't really know what he's doing and winds up killing him. The Marine, is he a bad guy and a murderer and a racist? No, I'm guaranteed this guy is not a racist, right? You know, he's just a guy who, Daniel Penny, he's a guy who tried to take control of a situation, but at the same time, he had no concept, because of poor training, of the lethality of what he was doing. He had no experience with it. He also didn't understand the legal framework of New York. And we're all victims of a society that allows mentally handicapped people who are dangerous to themselves and others free reign throughout New York City. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, though, I believe that Daniel Penny will probably not be convicted, because of the same thing, the Bernard Goetz trial. The kids were running away and he shot him. Like, I don't know how you justify shooting some kids who are running away, but he was found not guilty, which became a lightning rod issue in New York, because they're like, how can you just let this guy murder like kids, right? But obviously it's not that simple. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to retry the Bernie Goetz case, and I'm not going to retry this one. I'm saying it is a very complex issue. Now let's turn it away, and I'd like to ask what you think. Right, and I'm talking too much. What do you think about this situation? How would you view it? Do you see it? And there's no wrong. I'm just curious what your opinion is.
I think it's definitely a very important case, because it's going to set a precedent for like the future. Can people react this way to instances that are not physically threatening?
Yeah, and according to the law, we're not allowed to do that. Right. That being said, there's a jury of 12 people.
Yeah.
And we'll see. And, you know, even though the judge will say, well, you have to do this, try this, you know, case on the merits of the law. Yeah. A lot of times,
personal experience.
The personal experience trumps that. That's why I believe that he probably will get off, because I don't think a New York State jury will convict him. And it's funny, because people say, oh, you know, the African American community is this and that. But I'll tell you, a lot of African American people want proper, safe streets just as much as Caucasian, mm-hmm. you know, white communities, sure. Other communities. Everybody wants the same thing. We want to have safe streets. We want to be able to take the subway and not have to worry about anti-Asian hate or muggings or rapes, mm-hmm. or anything. But that's what we all want, the same thing. However, you know, the cops can't be everywhere, and we have a system where lots of poor, economically distressed, mentally distressed, really broken people, are running through the subway system. Yeah. That being said, it's a conservative talking point that New York is like this, you know, cesspool of violence. Dude, it's not even close to the violence of the 70s. Yeah. And we definitely had a crime spike because of the pandemic, but it's already like lessening. But overall, our way of dealing with mentally handicapped, mentally at risk people, emotionally disturbed persons is the term, in with emotionally disturbed persons, EDPs, creates the problem, because there should be more social structures. Mm-hmm. Sound like a good liberal here, but there should be more social structures that take care of them, mm-hmm. that keep them off the streets. And it's the systems that are failing them.
Do you think there's any case where Neely? No, his last name. I don't remember. The Marine.
Yeah. Daniel Penny.
Daniel Penny. Could sue the Marine Corps for improper training?
I don't, because the Marine training is also training for warfare.
Yeah.
So it's like, they're like not saying, hey, go use this on the street.
Right.
You know, they're like, you're on a battlefield and this is when you use it.
Well, remember
this,
right? Con Air? You ever seen a movie, Con Air?
You mean with Nick Cage?
Nick Cage, yeah.
That's, yeah, it's a terrible movie.
Yeah, but similar situation. What? He's defending his wife from some attackers, and he kills.
Oh, the beginning of the movie, right? Yeah. I forgot. I forgot.
Oh, he goes to jail. But right, yeah, right. He got the judge was like, "You're trained as a lethal weapon, and you need to use your training responsibly. And we're going to send you to jail for murdering this man."
Yeah, you know, movie is a movie, right? But I mean, give a good point, right? Like, I would say also that the jurisdictions are matter, like. I mean, there was the shooting death of that African-American individual where, you know, some certain people felt that he was a threat. And according to, I believe it was Florida, the stand your ground laws, they're well, you know, he felt a threat, go shoot him. Right. You know, right? Exactly. It was something like that. I'm getting it a little wrong, but you know what I'm talking about, right? Yeah. So the legal framework of each state is very different.
Yeah.
And I'm not an expert. I really wish we had a lawyer on it. But as I said, every state is very different. Now, it's interesting because I was looking at the legal framework of Texas, which probably has the most lax.
Shoot people anytime you want.
Yeah, the most lax stand your ground laws. And they're saying if you have cover, right, if you're not in danger and you come out of cover – this is Texas. Texas is like Wild Wild West compared to New York. If you have cover, meaning you have safety, and you come out of safety to assault. So, for example, they're talking about like road rage, like a guy is yelling at you and you get out of your car, right? You're suddenly not in a self-defense scenario anymore, right? So if you, again, Texas, where it's Wild Wild West, if you, this is lawyers that, that they have a whole podcast on this, right? At some point chase the person. So you see someone pissed you off and then you follow them and then confront them. That's not self-defense, right? This is mostly kind of road rage kind of thing. Yeah. But if you look at this situation, the guy was nowhere near Daniel Penny. Daniel Penny came to him and put the chokehold on. He was not here. His back was facing to him. So
he had no weapons.
Yeah, no weapons. Either. Right. And the next thing is, this is again Texas. Once the threat has been neutralized, going past that point of aggression, exceeding that level of aggression, meaning you neutralized. Now you start aggressing more. Escalate, right? You escalate. That's the word I was looking for. Thank you. Escalate the level. You are again now legally liable.
And as soon as he's on the ground, you should be done.
Right. So the issue is like, when do you do a chokehold? Now, let's get away from this side. When do you do a chokehold, right? You have a chokehold where you legitimately feel the guy could reach in his pants and grab a knife, which is actually I was in a very similar situation a long time ago where I felt the guy had a weapon, right? He had a weapon. And I restrained him and put him unconscious so that he could not grab that weapon. And did exactly what I did. It was like, he was out, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, wrapped him up with a shirt, right?
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that he couldn't get up. And I hogtied him. I wrapped his arms up with a shirt and also put one leg behind it. So he was hogtied, right? And then we got the police. So at that point, you know, I was in never any legal jeopardy. This was in Brooklyn many years ago, right? I was working, anyway, whatever. So it was Brooklyn, you know, not a nice part of Brooklyn either. Yeah. But say you've put him in a position like mount and you griff wrapped him, you took his back and he can't hurt you. He's not armed. Do what that black belt did where he put him in the crucifix position. Both arms are, controlled. So the people don't know the crucifix. You use one leg to your two legs to control one arm and your other arms are controlling the other. So you're perpendicular to him Jesus Christ on the cross, right? Yeah, obviously. And your body is behind his head. So the individual who is crucifix, his head is being a little bit cranked out, but he can't move. He can't punch you. He can't bite you. He can't kick you. And literally you should see this video. It's amazing because you could tell this guy's a black belt too, because he's just so chill. And he's completely done it. And he's smart. You can tell he's thinking about humane restraint. Where it's like, hey, this guy can't hurt me anymore. So I don't really need to hurt him anymore.
True.
Right. So the control aspects of, wrestling and judo and jiu-jitsu are very, very useful here. And you have to know your legal framework. This is one place where gi training can be very good. Using shirts to tie up wrists is something that is a big part of judo. Not as much in jiu-jitsu, although it happens, because a lot of times you tie up the guy's wrist and then use it to pin him, right? Known as tie-ups, right? Happens very much from the kimura position, but instead of finishing the kimura, you grab the skirt of the shirt and wrap it around, and the guy's arm is just trapped. These are very, very good arresting controls, and that's actually the origin of them, Japanese arresting controls. Mm. They work really well on t-shirts. They work on hoodies. They work on jackets. They work on anything, right? So in my academy, for my more senior students, it's something that I've shown them how to do this. So understanding body control, upper body restraint and control, which is something we always talk about in MMA, is absolutely essential. If he doesn't have access to a weapon, in New York City, you are legally not allowed to escalate further, like mm-hmm. elbow him in the head, you know, smash him with hammer fists, choke him. You're not eligible to do that unless you feel your life is threatened. So, for example, I'm choking one guy out, but his friend is going to come over and kick me in the head. Yes, I can continue that choke, yeah. You know, because obviously I'm still in danger, yeah. Right? This is very fraught. Now, so it seems sometimes like, because fights are chaotic, that the laws against the defender sometimes. I know a lot of people have told me that. They're like, wow, I'm going to have to fight this guy and then fight in court afterwards. So, you know, yeah, once you understand the law and once you understand really good body control, I think we can navigate these currents to our advantage. That being said, I'm not here going to litigate or discuss the merits of the law. That's not my expertise. What I'm saying is this is the way the law is in New York State, mm-hmm. and the tri-state area is basically the same. I would recommend all listeners to look up what your local laws are. And I know we have a lot of listeners in Canada, Australia, Israel, all over Europe. So I don't know what the laws are there. Look what your self-defense statutes say. And then, and you know what? This is what I did. I spoke to a defense attorney. This is a long time ago. I had him give a speech at our academy. Hey, this is defensible assault. So this is his defense. It was many years ago, but had a defense attorney saying, this is how I can defend you well. And just as a preparation of this podcast, I looked up these, like I said, these defense attorneys in Texas to see what it was. And they said, even as I said, in the Wild West of Texas, it's not like you can just go around shooting people at will. You know, if you were in cover and came out of cover and attacked, you're not legally defensible. If you chase them, you're not legally defensible. If you've isolated somehow the weapon or the threat, escalation is not permitted.
Yeah. And this guy wasn't, Texas. He wasn't alone on the train. There was other people with him helping control.
Right.
There was a whole lot of situations.
And really, you know, it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy for the person who was killed. It's a tragedy for Daniel Penny, the Marine. It's a tragedy for New York. It's everything is tragic. And what I want to do is skirt away from the people who don't live in New York. It's become a very hot issue. Skirt away from that issue of that passion and say both the sides on this issue, the people who said that it was excessive, and the people who said that, hey, you know, why can't we just protect ourselves? Both sides have legitimate points, right? And we have to navigate this. But the real issue for me is, how is the society we treating our mentally ill? Mm-hmm. You know, and how are we treating our economically disadvantaged? How are we policing the subway system? Like, there's so many times where female students of mine are like, man, it's like 1 a.m. I don't want to get on the subway. Like, that's terrible. Like, I lived in Japan. You should watch this show on Netflix. It's really cool. It's, I forgot what the English name is, but it's a show of like 3-year-old kids walking, doing a show. Yeah, you know the show, right? In Japan, you see 4-year-olds getting on the subway alone all the time. Mm. You see guys at 1 a.m. drunk out of their mind on the subway, women. And obviously Japan is not crime free, but it's so safe. How is it safe? Well, one, they have a larger police presence. 2, they take care of their mental, biggest one, they take care of their mentally ill. And I know this for a fact because one of my friends was mentally ill in Japan and became homeless and was taken care of by the Japanese system. Not even Japanese guy, he was an American guy, but he became mentally schizophrenic and he got tremendous care in Japan and kept him off the streets, kept him in a place where he couldn't hurt himself and he couldn't hurt other people until they could actually wind up getting him home. So their social structures are such that they've developed a much safer society. And also they don't allow poverty to get as out of hand, mm-hmm. right? There's other cultural issues, but aside from that, they're actual concrete policies that they take care of mentally ill. They're more like, especially not like in Japan, obviously, like suicide is a big deal. But when I'm saying mentally, I mean schizophrenic and, you know, it's kind of mentally ill where they can become homeless and dangerous on the street, mm-hmm. not the mentally ill where they hurt themselves. That's a place where in Japan, people who are depressed and things like that feel a lot of shame and they don't seek out help. That's not what I'm talking about. That is an issue in Japan. What I'm talking about is the schizophrenia. And all these other issues that lead people to homelessness and violence right. on the street. And even Japan does have problems. Like they had a crazy person wield a knife and try to hurt some people. But it's so rare in Japan compared to New York. Like anytime you're on New York subway at 1 a.m., you're always going to meet some weirdo. You know, like it's just, and there's homeless everywhere, you know. Right. You know, it's not like as a society we have to have some culpability for this. Aside from these two individuals, and it's a tragedy all around. That being said, navigating the legal system as martial artists is some, I recommend all our listeners go out. If you can talk to a defense attorney, don't take what I said here as legal advice, but navigate, find a defense attorney, find someone who is experienced in this. Also look up your legal statutes and understand how to navigate your local, laws. Yeah. And understand how to control people very, very well. I always say this for MMA, for everything. Upper body controls are the foundation of self-defense. Control a guy, can't hurt you. Very simple.
There you go. So find out the laws and then go get in a fight. Find the line and get close to it, but don't go over it. And move to Texas, maybe.
Move to Texas.
Was this guy from New York, or I don't remember where he come. Where
the
he,
victim or the
the no the Marine.
Marine. No, Daniel Penny was not from New York. I know he was a Marine originally, but he is not from New York. He's not a native New Yorker. He had moved here and trying to make his life here new. You know, so
That explains a little bit.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's a tragedy all around, and it's funny because. Not funny. It's interesting because he would not have been charged with had not the public outcry been so strong from certain segments. And they said some groups called this a type of lynching and white vigilantism against people of color. And you know, I'm not saying I really don't think he.
I don't think color, race had anything to do with it.
It didn't, but it did. Meaning,
I mean, yeah,
the end result, it doesn't have to do like he wasn't looking at the guy's skin color and wasn't. But you have like, you know, the communities that are most at risk in New York are communities of color. Yeah.
He might not have been there if he had been taken care.
Exactly.
Of.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Like you're a witch, right, dude? You're probably getting the care. You have insurance. You get medical care, right? You know, his mother wouldn't have been murdered. Because they lived in such a distressed neighborhood, right? Yeah. Now, of course, there are other people who live in those neighborhoods who are not, you know, black. But, you know, the statistics are what.
Yeah. So hopefully we don't become blinded by the sensationalism of this case and actually take it higher than just like one guy versus another guy.
Exactly.
This is a larger issue that goes a lot deeper.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's like there's a problem here that's beyond these two people. We created this tragedy for our social missteps. Yeah. And it happened to be these two people, but it could have been anybody else in any situation. And I've been in situations like that where I was, you know, in a scenario where a emotionally disturbed person who was not on drugs or something was potentially violent to me and had to, you know, restrain them. I've had that scenario, mm-hmm. right? And I think a lot of New Yorkers have, like not even martial art people, you know, just it's just part of like, you know, growing up in New York in the 80s, you know, it was crazy. Not as dangerous now, but still, post-pandemic, we have seen a spike in random violence. And the issue is, you know, New York has always had certain types of... So my mom said this, right? So my mom has a better memory of the 70s than I do because I was a kid. Yes, it wasn't the Stone Age. But
1870s?
1970s, oh, okay. Matt. Thank you.
He's a vampire.
But she has a better message. And she said something very true. And she said, I didn't feel like I could predict where I would be in danger. Meaning, you went to this neighborhood at this time, yeah, sketch. If you stayed over here at this time, yeah, it was predictable. You'd be safe, right? The violence that we're experiencing now is much more random and cuts across class lines because it's, you know, 4 PM. Like, there was a shooting in Penn Station. An incident in Penn Station recently, right in the middle of rush hour. And it happened that, you know, one of the people died. Like, the violence that we're seeing post-pandemic is fueled by a lot of mental distress that cuts across all sorts of class and gender and geographic divides. So you can be anywhere in New York and possibly have an experience that you, in the 70s, you're like, oh, this here at this point in this time, that's dangerous. But if I stay here, like I said, it was like more predictable, you know? Yeah. Not completely. Right now, like I'm walking down the street. I close my academy at night. I walk down the street and my, you know, spidey sense is up because I don't care if it's 34th Street, middle of Manhattan. Like, it could happen anywhere at any time.
Do you think that's an argument to have more gangs in New York because they have their turfs and they stay in their areas?
You know, it's interesting because that's what happens in Japan. It's this interesting thing because the Yakuza is in Japan. Yakuza, Japanese mafia, is a police force as well as a crime force, meaning like in their turf, they keep things like down and they're a type of social structure that while criminal gets rid of street crime in this area. And it's funny, we had the same thing in the Bronx. Back in the Bronx, there was an area controlled by the American mafia, the Italian mafia. And you're like, there's this statue in the Bronx. I forgot exactly where it is, but it's a religious statue, like a Mother Mary or something, right? And she has like ruby eyes that are really, really expensive, but nobody touches them because the mafia will kill you, right? You know, like that's just protected, still? Right? Oh, yeah, totally. Oh, still. Wow. I forgot where it is, but it's in the
I gotta find this
like,
thing. I need
Pelham Bay or something, right? Yeah, you're dead. Like, they'll find you and kill you, right? Yeah. So at some level, organized crime is this protective blanket in Japan, which is kind of very interesting. But that has actually since been – the Yakuza have actually been since been dismantled in Japan because they overstepped into some – they lost the control of their own organizations. And Japan government reacted. So they had that blanket for a while, but even, you know, you can never really trust criminal organizations to be act responsibly. That's right. True. But, I had an incident in Japan with the Yakuza person. So this is very interesting because they control turf. One of my friends, she was a chanson singer and she would do busking. Busking for the people who know singing on the street corner, right? And so you had to pay protection to the Yakuza if you wanted to sing on the street corner. And she didn't know that because she didn't speak Japanese. She just got there. She would travel. She was she's a French woman, but she was a Buddhist monk and she would live in Thailand and do like Buddhist training. But then she would go and sing around to make money to live and, you know, like things like that. So actually she has a PhD in like molecular biology and gave it all up to her chemistry. Very interesting lady, right?
Yeah.
Friend of mine, right? So she just became a Buddhist monk and she would travel like a little bit, busk, make some money and then go back to Thailand. And actually all the busking money she donated to like at-risk kids and stuff. Like she never kept it, right? This is a really interesting, really, really cool lady. And she was in her 50s when I met her. She's probably not alive anymore, I think, because
she's doing 30. Well. She's a Buddhist monk. They lived 300.
I mean, yeah, maybe it's possible. 85. She's probably in her 80s now. You know, this was 30 years ago. You never know. You never know. So the Yakuza were going to beat her up.
Beat her up.
Yeah. Like because they didn't pay
the
protection.
For the money.
Right. Well, they, but she didn't understand. She didn't speak Japanese, right? And so they had these funny the toughs that the Yakuza hired. Were not Japanese. That in the 80s, they would hire soldiers from a lot of different places, but actually a lot of them were ex-Israeli soldiers that were, I don't know how they wound up in Japan, but they became the ground forces. And now there's like a mafia in Japan that's Chinese based and it's very different now. But I had an incident speaking with an Israeli who wanted to beat up my friend for not paying protection money to the Japanese. It was kind of a weird incident. And we were able to...
Sort of a joke.
Right, right. We were able to
diffuse it.
Diffuse it. And she had to pay us a little money. But it was also like very, very, very scary at that moment because it wasn't one of them. It was like... They don't move in individuals. They're smart. They move in like groups of five,
I play
six.
The Yakuza video game.
Yeah, I don't care. I don't care how tough you are. Six guys with, you know, 6-1. That's not good odds, right? That's not good odds. So that was interesting. But I think what it is that we have to find some solution to what we're doing. Like I don't know what that is, but a social solution. I'm more in the liberal bent, where I believe that social safety nets, insurance, healthcare, particularly mental healthcare, and we need it. Like, people need more mental healthcare. Even people who are not severely mentally distressed.
I wish I could go to therapy.
Exactly, right. I mean, you know, like, I had a student and he told me, he's like, you know, yeah, I go to therapy. I'm like, man, that's so smart. You know, you're a smart dude. You know, having access to mental healthcare, just like having access to regular healthcare, is part of a healthy approach and a smart approach to living your life. Yeah. You can't, especially post pandemic, we're living in you know what PTSD is, right?
Yeah.
The world is still in PTSD.
Sure.
We're economically distressed, you know, we're socially distressed and we're really figuring out how we're going to orient everything. Everything's kind of in flux because like even in work, like, you know, they're saying, oh, well, we're going to do hybrid work and instead of like people at work all time. And we had this massive, you know, economic downturn right after the pandemic, which, you know, we discussed as just hurt our businesses. The social structures that we found familiar are rewriting themselves. So there's a lot of stress. It's, you know, not hiring. My wife just graduated school and she graduated amazing, summa cum laude.
Congratulations.
Right? But job market's tough now. It's tough, right? For tech workers, right? Mm. So it's a tough place economically, socially. Now we also, myself included, know a lot of people who passed away from COVID or COVID-related things. Man, this is our culture, our world is still in PTSD. And of course, to think that there isn't a reaction back, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. You think there's not going to be a pushback to social violence and social chaos? You're smoking crack, you know? And I mean, drug addiction, suicidal ideation, all these things are up, you know, especially among youth. You know, so there's larger than these issue, these two people, but this issue itself was tragic. And also, understanding now on a personal level, like I said, how do we navigate our legal landscapes is something that every martial artist should try to think about. You know,
it's important. Like Barney Fife, your hands are registered weapons. You ever watch Andy Griffith Show? What? What's happening?
I'm trying to think back to the last time I watched Andy Griffith. It was probably 1975.
Andy, knees, hands, or register weapons. That was my best Barney Fife.
What? Wait. I'm trying to think. Barney Fife. Oh, that was his deputy.
Yeah.
Who is the what was the military one?
Gomer Pyle?
Gomer Pyle, yes. Gomer Pyle.
Yeah.
That was a different one.
Yeah, but they were connected.
Oh, they were connected.
Cinematic universe.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It's like Marvel.
Yes, the early Marvels. Andy Griffith and Gomer Pyle.
All right.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter at @Marshall_culture and on Instagram at @MarshallCultureCast. Please leave a review on iTunes, and we'll see you next time on the Marshall Culture Podcast.